Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Mixed rulings. In a blow to President Trump, the Supreme Court upholds prosecutors' right to see his tax returns and financial records while rejecting Congress's push for access to many of the same documents. Then, surging COVID infections, officials scramble to flatten new curves as the debate on when to reopen schools heats up. Plus, defying the odds, a Maryland nursing home with zero COVID-19 infections and the early steps that kept residents alive.
When I heard the president say we only had 15 cases and he thought that by the end of the week it would be zero, I knew that it was time that we take action.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. There are two major stories tonight. The U.S. Supreme Court rules on subpoenas for President Trump's financial records and underscores that no one is above the law. And the nation struggles to stop COVID-19, as surging infections show no one is beyond its reach. First, today's Supreme Court decisions. John Yang begins our coverage.
The Supreme Court flatly rejected President Trump's claim that he is completely immune from a state criminal investigation as long as he's in office. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the decision, saying, "No citizen, not even the president, is categorically above the common duty to produce evidence when called upon in a criminal proceeding." The 7-2 majority included Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, the court's two Trump appointees. Roberts also said a president may avail himself of the same protections available to every other citizen to try to block a subpoena. So the case was returned to the lower courts to give President Trump an opportunity to make those arguments, meaning the question may not be finally settled for some time. The dissenters, Justice Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, said a sitting president deserves special consideration. Alito wrote, "It is unrealistic to think that the prospect of possible criminal prosecution will not interfere with the performance of the duties of the office." Today's ruling was a milestone, the first time justices said whether a president must comply with a state criminal investigation. It was a stinging rebuke for a president who has a sweeping view of his powers.
"This is a political witch hunt, the likes of which nobody's ever seen before. It's a pure witch hunt. It's a hoax."
Marcia Coyle is chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal.
Is there a message to a president who says he has his Article II powers allow him to do whatever he wants?
John, I think that opinion is a clear message to a sitting president that your Article II powers are not unlimited. Very clear message. This was, a cross-ideological opinion, a very strong precedent for the future.
A Manhattan grand jury convened by District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. subpoenaed records, including the president's zealously guarded tax returns, dating back to 2011. Andrea Bernstein co-hosts WNYC Radio and ProPublica's podcast, Trump Inc.
The president consistently files different sets of information on his tax documents and on other documents. For example, bank loan documents, when you want your value to look high, the numbers don't necessarily match tax documents. When you want the numbers to look low, so you pay less taxes. So that is a pattern that the district attorney could possibly turn up as a byproduct of this investigation.
In a separate case, the same 7-2 lineup rejected the president's arguments about broader subpoenas issued by several House committees. But it also turned away the congressional claim to virtually unlimited subpoena power. Again, Roberts wrote the majority opinion. Far from accounting for separation of powers concerns, the House's approach aggravates them.
The Chief Justice was very disappointed. He said, traditionally, the House and the executive branch and the legislative branch work these things out together. But apparently, he said, that process has broken down. Robert said, what we need here is a balanced approach, and it has to take into consideration that these are two independent branches of our government.
This matter, too, was sent back to the lower courts with instructions to determine whether the House subpoenas serve a legislative purpose and are not too broad. In his dissent, Thomas said, Congress has no power to issue a legislative subpoena for private, non-official documents, whether they belong to the president or not. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi vowed to keep seeking the material.
We will continue to press our case in the lower courts.
Former Trump attorney Michael Cohen plays a key role in both subpoenas. His claim that he was the middleman for hush money payments to two women who say they had sexual relationships with Mr. Trump, which the president denies, is part of the grand jury investigation.
He turned over records. We've seen them. He turned them over when he testified before the House in 2019, that the check signed by Donald Trump for $35,000, part of the hush money payment. So we know that those documents exist.
Raise your right hand.
And his congressional testimony triggered the House request.
It was my experience that Mr. Trump inflated his total assets.
House committees want the records to look for possible financial wrongdoing in property deals and whether overseas loans make the president vulnerable to foreign influence. But the need for more court proceedings and rules about grand jury secrecy means it's unlikely that any of these documents would be made public until after the election. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
Now that the Supreme Court has spoken, what consequences will these rulings have on the powers of the president and those who seek to investigate him? We get two perspectives tonight. Mary McCord is a former prosecutor who became the Justice Department's top national security official during the Obama administration. She's now at Georgetown University. And Jesse Panuccio was the department's number three official, the acting associate attorney general in the Trump administration, just until last year. He's now in private practice. And we welcome both of you to the program. I want to begin with the justice's ruling on the Manhattan District Attorney case. And Mary McCord, to you first, what do you make of the justice's reasoning here? And how much of a setback do you think this is for the president?
Well, this was an important decision because all nine justices, including the dissenters, agreed that there was no absolute immunity that the president could assert that would prevent him from having to respond to a criminal subpoena. And the justices were very, you know, again, unanimous in this. And although some of them differed in their rationale, it's important because historically, for 200 years, as the Chief Justice pointed out, no person has been above the law, and that includes the president. So this was a real victory for the New York attorney, Cy Vance. It was a real rebuke to that overreach, that assertion of absolute immunity, which even the president had gone farther than the Solicitor General had gone in that case.
So, Jesse Panuccio, was it a miscalculation for the president's attorneys to make the argument they did to try to argue that the president was immune?
Well, Judy, good evening. Thanks for having me. I don't think it was a miscalculation. If you look at what the Supreme Court did today, it gave the president a loss on absolute immunity, but politically, he probably got a win. These cases will continue to be litigated. They will be litigated well past the election. So these subpoenas, if they are ever enforced, will be enforced after that time. And then legally, in both the New York case and the congressional case, the Supreme Court gave the president a lot to work with in terms of making arguments going forward. Concentrating on the New York case, the Supreme Court was very clear in recognizing that local prosecutors can be motivated improperly by politics or political retaliation or bad faith. And the court made very clear that the federal courts must be open to the president to protect him from that kind of local prosecutorial misconduct.
Well, the president doesn't seem to think it's a win. As you heard, he's calling it a political witch hunt and a hoax. But Mary McCord, back to you on what recourse the president now has when it comes to his ability to stop what the Manhattan DA is trying to go after. He can rest now, as I understand it, on an argument, I'm just an ordinary citizen, but I still think what you're doing has no foundation. Can he not?
So in this case, the president had, again, put all of his eggs in one basket when he brought this case to try to stop these subpoenas. He had argued he was absolutely immune. So he had never made other arguments that an ordinary person might make, such as saying this subpoena is too burdensome, this subpoena has brought in bad faith or for harassment, this subpoena, you know, those types of arguments, this subpoena causes constitutional problems. So what the Supreme Court said is we're not vacating the lower opinion. Right, we're affirming the lower court opinion, which denied absolute immunity. That was the Second Circuit opinion. But they said that even the Second Circuit had said this case should go back to this to the district court in case the president has any other arguments he wants to make, such as burden, such as harassment, such as abuse, that then he could make those like an ordinary citizen. The only thing, so the Supreme Court was essentially just affirming what the Second Circuit had already said, which is no absolute immunity, but you can make other arguments you might want to make, President. I think it's important, though, to recognize that even in doing that, the Supreme Court did say, in considering the arguments that would be made, the lower court should consider the fact that this is the president, right? Not necessarily special treatment, but in analyzing the arguments, the person making the arguments, in this case, the president, just like any other person, would make arguments unique to him. In this case, he had made no arguments at all unique to this subpoena by Cy Vance in this case about how it might burden him, how it might have been abusive or harassing. And, you know, he's saying the things he's saying, but he'll have to make arguments that would convince a court that this is overreach. And there's nothing about the Supreme Court's decision that suggests that the Supreme Court thought that these subpoenas were overreach or abusive or harassing.
But Jesse Pannuccio, I hear you saying that you think that is what the president's attorneys are now likely to do. Is that right?
Well, I think that's right. And respectfully, I don't think it's true that there's nothing in the opinion that speaks to whether the court thought the subpoena by Mr. Vance was overreaching. At the very outset of the opinion, the Supreme Court calls the investigation opaquely described. It notes, reading between the lines, I think with some disapproval, that the subpoena simply was a word-for-word copy of a congressional subpoena. And then after it rejects claims of absolute immunity, it goes on very clearly to say that the president is a special office under the Constitution, that separation of powers does matter, and there are special considerations when it comes to a president and local prosecutors, such as the fact that a local prosecutor can be improperly politically motivated. And I read the opinion as saying the president can begin to probe those motivations. And most interestingly, this is going back probably to the SDNY. This is the very same court that a few years ago said that the state of New York could take discovery into the motivations of Secretary Wilbur Ross in the census case. So if I were the president's lawyers, I think I would say, I want discovery into the motivations of Cy Vance. I want to know what his prosecutors did to come up with this subpoena, whether they had contact with any political actors, whether they are retaliating against me because of decisions I've made in relation to the state of New York and federal policies. I think that's all open now under the Supreme Court's opinion.
And we'll wait and see what happens in that regard. But more broadly speaking, in terms of the powers of the presidency, the office of the presidency going forward, I saw Mary McCord some analysis today saying that the fact that the justices were even asked to say what they said today in a way weakens or takes something away from the president's prerogative. How do you see that argument?
Are you speaking particularly of the second case, the case involving the House of subpoenas?
I think both cases.
Yeah. So, you know, historically, you really saw this in the Supreme Court's decision in the Mazars and Deutsche Bank case, that historically, these types of disputes between branches, now granted, the Cy Vance case is not a dispute between branches, but historically disputes between branches have been resolved between the branches. They have not gone to the courts very often, and they've never gone up to the Supreme Court. And so I think what you saw was a level of disappointment, frankly, from the Supreme Court that it really has to be dealing with these things, notwithstanding that, of course, it accepted cert in these and granted certiorari so it could review them because they were important issues that that were being pressed by the president and by his attorneys in the face of rulings against him below. It's also important, I think, to recognized that in the second case, the Mazars case, even though that ends up in a vacator of the opinion and a remand, there really wasn't a clear winner in that case, because essentially what the Supreme Court said is both parties' positions were too extreme, and both parties, what they've asked for would runs into separation of powers concerns, because you've got two political co-equal branches in conflict with each other. The president wanted to go too far that would undercut Congress's important Article I functions, and it thought that Congress went too far as well.
And just quickly, Jesse Panuccio, what about, do you see a cost to the office of the presidency in the fact that the court had to deal with this issue?
Well, power, there can be a cost, because you ultimately get a ruling and that can constrain what you can do as president going forward. But I think in both of these opinions, the court was at pains to leave many questions open for another day. In the congressional opinion, the court notes toward the end that one case every 200 years is not enough to flesh out all of the considerations that may matter to federal courts and to Congress and the president going forward. So I think while ultimately the claims of absolute immunity were rejected today, the court left open plenty of avenues for this president and future presidents to make arguments about presidential prerogative, and frankly, to future Congresses. And I think the court was cognizant of the fact that you don't know what exact shape future controversies will take between Congress and the president. You only know that since the founding of the country, they have always existed and they will continue to exist. And so the court left a lot of room for, I think, future maneuverability.
For sure, two important rulings. Jesse Panuccio, Mary McCord, thank you both for joining us to explore all this. Thank you.
Good night. Stay well. Thank you.
Before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about another podcast from our promotional partners at Reveal. The investigative podcast Reveal is now out with American Rehab, an 8-part serial. They've uncovered an American solution to treating drug addiction: work. People enter rehab expecting treatment. Instead, they're sent to work at oil refineries, construction sites, and warehouses for no pay. These rehabs have created an unpaid shadow workforce tens of thousands of people strong. And Reveal finds this all started with a secretive cult from the 1960s. You can listen to American Rehab by subscribing to Reveal wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, the latest on the summer surge of the coronavirus pandemic. The number of dead topped 550,000 worldwide today, including 133,000 here in the United States. And the number of new infections shows no signs of abating. White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor reports.
Day by day, the new surge in COVID-19 cases is growing. Much of the country is now steadily reporting increased infections. And today, there were new single-day highs in Alabama and Montana and other parts of the country. Only two states, Vermont and New Hampshire, are seeing infections decline, according to the New York Times. Governors are scrambling to try to flatten the new curve after their states reopened.
If you're in those vulnerable age groups or have the comorbidities, be very careful about the types of close contact you have. Avoid crowds at all costs, because those are going to be the situations, where you're going to be most at risk.
Today, the nation's top infectious diseases doctor advised states to pause lifting restrictions. Dr. Anthony Fauci spoke on an online forum in Washington.
So rather than think in terms of reverting back down to a complete shutdown, I would think we need to get the states pausing in their opening process, looking at what did not work well, and try to mitigate that.
Meanwhile, the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention insisted his agency is not revising its guidelines for schools to reopen.
It's not a revision of the guidelines. It's just to provide additional information to help the schools be able to use the guidance that we put forward.
Robert Redfield spoke a day after President Trump called the CDC's standards impractical. Yesterday, Vice President Pence said new guidelines would be coming out next week as a result of the president's criticism. At the Capitol, debate also heated up over reopening schools. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi warned against putting children at risk.
This administration seems to be turning its back on science and instead saying, open up, take a risk. Oh, by the way, open up the schools. Overwhelmingly, the teachers want to open up the schools, but it has to be safe for the children.
But House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy argued that remote learning will hurt a generation of students, and he urged incentives for schools to resume.
You can protect them from liability, so schools will actually have a willingness and a desire to open and not a fear that they're going to be sued.
The pandemic's economic damage keeps mounting as well. The Labor Department said today more than 1.3 million Americans filed for unemployment benefits last week. The world's other hotspots are also struggling to make headway. Today, India reported 25,000 new cases in 24 hours. In hard-hit Mumbai, doctors went door-to-door to test residents for the virus. And the government of Serbia dropped plans for a weekend lockdown after two nights of violent protests over the restrictions. Officials also banned gatherings of more than 10 people in Belgrade. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Yamiche Alcindor.
In the day's other news, President Trump's former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, has returned to federal prison. He had been spotted at a Manhattan restaurant, and officials say he rejected terms of his home confinement. Cohen was released in May after serving 10 months for tax evasion, campaign finance fraud, and lying to Congress. His full sentence runs through November of 2021. The judge in the Michael Flynn case is now asking a full federal appeals court to consider the case. The former national security advisor initially pled guilty to lying to the FBI. Later, the Justice Department moved to drop the charges, but the judge refused. Last month, a panel of the appeals court ordered the charges dismissed. The ousted U.S. attorney in Manhattan was interviewed today by the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. Jeffrey Berman had been leading probes of President Trump's associates when he was forced out. He told lawmakers that Attorney General William Barr offered him another position to leave of his own accord. Afterward, Democratic Committee Chair Jerry Nadler was sharply critical.
The Attorney General repeatedly attempted to entice Berman to step down voluntarily, even after Berman made clear that his leaving would disrupt certain sensitive cases. We don't know yet if the Attorney General's conduct is criminal, but that kind of quid pro quo gets awfully close to bribery.
Attorney General Barr goes before the committee later this month. Sheriff's investigators in Southern California confirmed today that a black man found hanging in a tree died by suicide. They said that Robert Fuller suffered from mental illness. The discovery of his body in Palmdale last month sparked a protest. His family has said that Fuller would never have taken his own life. The Trump administration has banned three senior Chinese Communist Party members from entering the U.S. Today's action accuses them of subjecting Uyghurs and other minorities to forced labor, mass detentions, and other abuses. One of the officials is a member of the ruling Politburo. In the presidential campaign, Democratic nominee-to-be Joe Biden offered a sweeping plan to rebuild manufacturing after the pandemic. He spoke in Dunmore, Pennsylvania, and called for spending $700 billion on American-made goods and on research and development.
We need to strengthen our industrial base as long-term sources of middle-class job creation. Let's use this opportunity to take bold investments in American industry and innovation so the future is made in America, all in America.
On the Republican side, Vice President Pence also campaigned across Pennsylvania today. The Wisconsin State Supreme Court today upheld laws that limit the power of the Democratic Attorney General. They were passed by a lame duck Republican-led legislature after the 2018 election. The measures also targeted the Democratic governor who was elected that same year. On Wall Street, stocks mostly lost ground on worries about the COVID-19 surge. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 361 points to close at 25,706. The Nasdaq added 55 points, but the S&P 500 slipped 17. And for the first time, a woman is joining the U.S. Army's elite Green Berets. Officials have not released her identity, but they say she was graduated today from the Special Forces Qualification Course at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. In all, the Army has about 6,700 Green Berets. Still to come on the NewsHour, international students at U.S. universities on the administration's threat to deport them. One-on-one, White House advisor Peter Navarro talks trade, economic recovery, and the response to COVID-19. Plus, a Maryland nursing home with zero infections.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
New rules for foreign college students sent shockwaves through American academic institutions this week. On Monday, the Department of Homeland Security said all of the roughly 1 million international students who are currently enrolled in the U.S. must attend at least one in-person class this fall, or they will be denied visas to either enter or stay in the country. The news came as both colleges and students are struggling to make plans for the fall semester in the middle of a pandemic. We start by hearing from some of the students reacting to the news.
I'm Elizabeth Gimba. I'm from Kenya in South Sudan, and I'm currently enrolled at Skidmore College.
I'm Raul Romero. I'm from Caracas, Venezuela.
Hello, my name is Yuxiao Wu. I also go by Isabel. I'm originally from China. I study Latin American history.
So I'm Jaskeer Atpanjrat. I'm originally from India, but I reside in New York City.
My name is Niall Nair. I am from the islands of Fiji. I'm proud to say I'm one of the first geneticists out of the Pacific Islands. My entire worldview of how we should be approaching science and medicine changed by the opportunities I was afforded by coming to the United States.
My research is based on solely based on the library sources I have. And the California library system is one of the largest library systems in the US, in the world. And this is just a tremendous resource for researchers like me.
You have hands-on experience of what you dream of in the United States. And now it's being taken away from me in many ways. So I don't know what to think about it.
The new regulation, again, blindsided us completely. And the choices I'm faced with is either risk my life and health and go to class in person, or risk being deported, because even though I'm legally here.
We're basically having to make the choice of staying, continuing our education and becoming deportable, or going back to our countries and in many cases face a certain amount of risks. In Venezuela, it goes beyond the humanitarian crisis and the violence. There's also, you know, very poor internet connection. Blackouts occur daily. There's no constant supply of water.
I'm most concerned about my education because I don't think I have the luxury or the option of, for instance, taking a semester gap or deciding to go back home and take a break or anything of the sort.
There's like this constant, feeling that like I don't belong here, even though I'm like paying so much money and there's so much, and I'm on a student loan.
You know, we're here temporarily and we're not even being allowed to stay here temporarily.
I mean, it's tiring, it's hectic, it's frustrating, it's really draining. And there's not much we can always do from our side.
This law make me and a lot of international students feel that we are deserted by the country, we're unwelcome here. What is the most devastating thing for me is that feeling of rejection.
Harvard and MIT quickly filed a lawsuit to block the new rule, saying that it risks the health of students and faculty. One of the major institutions grappling with the change is the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Jeffrey Brown spoke with its chancellor, Rebecca Blank, a short time ago.
Rebecca Blank, thank you for joining us. We just heard from several students. I understand
You have some 5,800 foreign students on campus there. What do you think is the impact on them?
So this is an unwise and a terribly disruptive policy. We have many students who are in the middle of programs, many of them doing research work in labs with faculty. Having to tell them all to go home if they can't take in-person classes simply doesn't make any sense. Now, we're trying to run a hybrid model of both in-person and online classes this next semester. So I'm hoping many of them will be able to stay in Madison. But, you know, some students can't get home. Some students, it's not safe for them to be in their home country. The infections are far worse there than here in Madison. And some students, if they stop out, are just not good to get back.
Ken Cuccinelli, who's the acting deputy secretary at DHS, he said, if they're not going to be a student or they're going to be 100% online, then they don't have a basis to be here. They should go home and then they can return when the school opens. What is wrong with that logic?
So there are a lot of reasons for a student to be here on campus or in the United States while they're a registered student at our campuses. As I say, some of them may well be working with faculty, doing lab work and research, even if they are taking classes online. Some of them will be in situations where, there are literally no flights back to some countries right now. They can't get there. We had a whole number of students who stayed last spring when we went online. Almost all of them were international students. Many of them stayed over the summer because they were reasonably certain if they went home, they wouldn't be able to get back to school here this fall. It's quite clear that when schooling gets disrupted in this way, that once you stop out, once it becomes hard, it's just that much harder for students to get back in and finish their degree. And we want all of these students to get an education and to finish their degrees as fully and as quickly as possible.
Now, we're talking about the impact on students. What about the impact on schools like yours? Where are you in planning for the fall, and how much of an impact would this have?
So we are very busily trying to change our entire mode of operation so that we can have students back on campus and do so in a way that is safe for both our students as well as our faculty and staff. If we're able to accomplish that, and we believe we're going to be able to, then our international students should be able to stay under this order. But of course, it is possible that infections get a lot worse, various things happen, and that we would have to go to an all-online program at some point in the fall. And at that point, all of our foreign students would be under threat of going home. The effects on the institution, obviously, there's some institutional financial effects on this, but that's not the primary issue. Our students are part of our campus community. They're integrated in it a number of ways. We want them to be as safe and as healthy as possible. And in many cases for them, even if we're online, being in our dorms and staying here in Madison and not trying to get home to what are sometimes much more uncertain situations in their home countries.
But there are financial implications, right? A lot of these students would be paying full tuition. You wouldn't be getting that. So what would happen if this goes through and you lose these students?
Well, the effect on our tuition from our international students is about $200 million. That's not zero. Of course, if we go to a virtual and online situation, we will be having students dropping out who are domestic students as well as international. But as I say, my main concern about this policy is not the financial implications. We're going to do everything we can to try to be open in the fall. My concern is its impact on the education of students. And I should say the presence of foreign students at American universities has been incredibly important to this country. They go home, they become business leaders, they become political leaders. Their connections back to the United States from having been to our schools, of having spent time in the US, are just golden in terms of creating long-term relationships between this country and other countries.
Several critics of the administration and this move have seen it as a political attempt to force colleges to reopen in the fall. Do you see it that way?
I can't judge the motivations behind this regulation. As I say, I just think it's a very unwise regulation. It was issued with, as far as I know, no consultation with any of the universities or higher education organizations, and caught everybody by surprise, which of course makes it all the more disruptive.
And so briefly, what is the next step for you? I know several schools, Harvard and MIT among them, have sued already. You have not joined that suit, I don't think, yet. What's the next step?
So, you know, we are clearly trying to message to all of our students that we're doing everything we can to have online classes available to them, and that we are going to work with them to be able to stay here. We're looking at our legal options, whether it makes sense to join or not. As a state institution, we have certain constraints on that. But I've issued a very strong statement of opposition to this particular regulation. We've talked to our delegation in the U.S. Senate and Congress, some of them have been very supportive of this, and I hope we can actually get ICE and the administration to really rethink what they're doing here.
All right. Rebecca Blank is the Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
President Trump's new North American trade deal, the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, known as USMCA, was celebrated at the White House yesterday. Along with it come questions about the trade deal and what it means for the American economy. Peter Navarro is President Trump's trade advisor, and he joins us now from the White House. Peter Navarro, welcome again to the NewsHour. So President Trump called the predecessor to this deal the worst trade deal ever in a sentence. How is this trade agreement better?
NAFTA, which Joe Biden and a lot of other people voted for in 1992, was structured in a way, Judy, so that American jobs were lured into Mexico by Mexico's cheap labor and lax environmental controls, and Mexico lost a lot of its supply chain to China. What USMCA does is turn that completely on its head. It's structured in a way to make North America the manufacturing powerhouse of the world, and the way it helps American workers, and this is the most important part, it has local content regulations which provide, for example, in automobiles, that a certain percentage of that has to be American made, and to ensure that the jobs don't go south, there's also strict wage and environmental restrictions on Mexico. So this is a situation where rarely in a trade deal, Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. all benefit.
So let me ask you about that, because right now this deal does take effect as of yesterday, but it comes as all three countries are mired in recession because of the pandemic. And my understanding is that many of the deal's requirements, like expanding worker rights, opening up the flow of agriculture, these things have not been fully met, even as it has been signed. So there's still work to do.
Oh, there's certainly work to do, but it's nonetheless very good news for our manufacturing industries in North America. And also, it has things in it like relief for dairy farmers in places like Wisconsin, where the Canadians were putting exorbitant tariffs on. But, the bigger picture here, Judy, is that we're in a situation now where in the 2000s, China cheated on its trade deals and we lost millions of American jobs. What we have now is a situation where the Chinese Communist Party lied about this virus, the pandemic came here, and now not only are Americans dying in large numbers, we have 30 million Americans unemployed, and we're facing significant structural headwinds because of the Chinese Communist Party. Now, what I can tell you is that we are working overtime trying to make sure that we're bouncing back. So far, the numbers look good, but it's also true, Judy, that we're going to face structural headwinds as we move in time, as industries like hospitality and transportation, entertainment, all suffer from these pandemic effects from China. And what the mission of the president is to use his deep understanding of economics and business to make sure we navigate through those shoals. So in the next couple of weeks, there's going to be a new phase four deal that's going to be negotiated on Capitol Hill. And in the meantime, we're doing everything we can to bring our manufacturing jobs back to U.S. soil, which is going to be the key to reemploying those service sector refugees we lose in those the beleaguered sectors.
Okay, so you're making a number of allegations here about the Chinese, and I know a number of other countries have looked at this virus as well, but they seem to be doing a lot better than the United States in terms of keeping it under control. You're putting all the blame right now on China.
Yes.
And yet the United States, as you know, is leading the world in the number of people infected, the number of people who've died. And there's their fingers pointed at this president's leadership.
What I want to ask you is
if you look at this economy and you look at the president's leadership, I mean, you can't just point at China.
Well, I can't just point at China in the following sense. The reason why we have so many cases and China has less is this. Not only did China spawn the virus in November, they hid it for about 2 months. During that time, China restricted travel within China to contain the virus, but they sent thousands of Chinese nationals on aircraft, which many of them were infected and spread the seed of that virus. So that's part of the problem we're facing now. Now, here's the thing, Judy. We are now in a situation after going through several months of economic lockdown where we have really hard choices to make. And these are the hardest choices a president ever has to make. How fast do we open up the economy? What we learned in the first wave is that if a complete shutdown has tremendous economic damage, but it also kills people. It kills people through alcoholism, depression, more drug use, things like that. So what we're trying to do now is balance that as we open up, and it's a work in progress. We had hoped that the virus would subside somewhat in the summertime with the heat and humidity. Virtually every scientist thought that was going to happen. It hasn't, but we're managing that. And the good thing here, Judy, is that, and I'm directly at the center of much of this, we are building our strategic national stockpiles for personal protective equipment and medicines. That's going very well. We're much more sophisticated now about managing the issue. But you know, this is war. This is a wartime president. This is the Chinese virus. And I'm not going to sugarcoat anything today. We've got a fight on our hands.
And there are so many things to raise with you about all that you've said, Peter Navarro. But specifically, let me just move quickly ahead to what Joe Biden said today. He has now rolled out his own plan for improving the economy. He said this president has created an economy that caters to Wall Street. And what he's doing, he said, I've got a plan that's going to bring back jobs that have been lost this year. I'm going to create at least 5 million more jobs with sweeping investments in domestic technology. I'm going to reduce our dependence on foreign countries that supply critical goods. I'm going to implement trade and tax policies that empower U.S. workers. In other words, he is saying this president has failed on all those fronts.
So, Joe Biden was around for 44 years and basically helped oversee the offshoring of American jobs, turned his back on workers. In 3.5 years leading up to January 15th, this president was the greatest president, jobs president in history. And in terms of catering to Wall Street, guess what? We had the lowest unemployment rate ever in history for blacks, Hispanics, Asians, women. And this everything looked great because of the president's policies. Now, I thought it was, you know, the saying, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. When I looked at Joe Biden's plan, all of what he was doing was copying all the things that we've been doing as an administration with respect to Buy American, onshoring jobs, increasing manufacturing. Don't forget, Judy, during the Obama-Biden years, they lost 200,000 manufacturing jobs net. During this presidency, we've added over 500,000. So remember, 44 years of Joe Biden, nothing but offshoring American jobs, 3.5 years, the greatest jobs president in history.
If I could just quickly quote, there's reporting today that Steve Bannon, who, of course, has been a close advisor to the president, said when it comes to this Buy American proposal from Joe Biden, that the Trump administration was caught flat-footed. There's reporting that the administration has been trying to put together its own proposal, quote, Buy American proposal, but it hasn't been able to come to an agreement. Has the administration, has the White House been delayed in trying to come up with your own proposal on how to improve the economy?
Yeah, I've personally watched the president sign 5 different Buy American orders. We've had a tremendous reduction in waivers. We've had a tremendous increase in the amount of government procurement that goes to Buy American. We've had a great success with Buy American. It is the president's 2 simple rules. The next challenge we face, and this is going to be a very difficult one, but we are committed and engaged, which is to bring our medicines and our medical supplies and equipment production and supply chains home. And it's a struggle, but we've seen, for example, we brought factories in Arizona and Rhode Island on N95 masks. We stood up a factory in 17 days in Kokomo, Indiana, by General Motors, and we've become the ventilator export king of the world. We're producing 20 million swabs now a month in Guilford, Maine. So we are the Buy American presidency, and I'm proud to have been at the president's side when he signed those orders, and I've been very active in terms of implementing them. We have work to do on the pharmaceutical and supply chains.
Two other quick questions about China. There was a China trade deal that had been negotiated before the pandemic hit. It required China to buy more U.S. goods, but there wasn't enforcement as part of that. Can you require that China do what it was supposed to do under that agreement?
There are clear enforcement mechanisms in the Phase One deal. To date, it's absolutely true that China has underperformed with respect to its purchases, but we've been assured by the Chinese that by the end of the year they will make good on those. But this is Ronald Reagan territory, trust but verify. Let's see what happens. Let's remember what I told you at the beginning of this interview. During the 2000s, China cheated and they stole our jobs. Today, they lied to us, and they're killing Americans with that virus.
And does President Trump still consider President Xi Jinping a friend?
You'd have to ask the president that, but I can assure you there's no one inside the perimeter of this White House that has a high level of trust in the Chinese Communist Party at this point, particularly with respect to their behavior on this Chinese virus.
Peter Navarro, thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy.
Of the nation's nearly 130,000 coronavirus deaths, more than 40,000 have been in nursing homes. Amna Nawaz brings us the story of one facility that is beating the odds.
I'm joined now by Reverend Derek DeWitt. He's the director of the Maryland Baptist Aged Home. It's a 100-year-old nursing home that has had zero cases of COVID-19. Reverend DeWitt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So everyone knows the numbers, right? When you look at COVID deaths in long-term care facilities around the country, they make up some 40% of all COVID deaths in the nation. In Maryland, I think the number is over 60%. How did you beat the odds?
Well, I think the key was early mitigation, early proactive steps to make sure that this disease did not enter into our nursing home. And one of the things that I did was I just listened to the news around the world and how this was affecting other countries. And then when I heard the president say we only had 15 cases and he thought that by the end of the week it would be zero.
When you have 15 people and the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero.
I knew that it was time that we take action.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you basically didn't believe the president and took early action to lock down. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct in a sense. I mean, I think us being in an underprivileged and underserved area of Baltimore City, we've kind of gotten used to the fact that if help is going to come, it's probably going to come too late. So we need to be prepared to take care of ourselves.
So tell me a little bit about what exactly you did. When you say you acted early, what steps did you put into place back in February?
Well, the first thing we did, probably very end of February, 1st of March, we locked down the facility. We allowed no visitors in or out. We knew that if the disease was going to get into the nursing home, it was going to come from the outside. And probably it was going to be an employee that brought it in. So we have a very rigorous screening process when they come to work. And it's almost an hour-to-hour detail on what you did the 12 hours or 14 hours that you weren't at work. Who did you see? Who were you with? We take their temperatures. Everybody's wearing masks, gown, gloves when they have any contact with residents. We had a full-time quality assurance infection control nurse for years who set up a lot of measures that would help us in time of catastrophe or pandemic or even an epidemic, I took a lot of criticism for having a full-time person in a 30-bed facility, which most, you know, facilities even three times as large don't have a full-time infection control person. But then being a faith-based facility, a lot of people said, hey, you're overreacting. I thought you were, you know, a man of God and you had faith in God. And I just simply replied that, you know, to be forewarned is to be forearmed. And, you know, I have faith in God, but I still wear my seatbelt when I get in the car.
One of the things we've heard from other people who run nursing homes and long-term care facilities is that they waited in some ways to lock down because they're also worried about the emotional well-being of their residents. And locking everyone down and keeping everyone in their rooms isn't necessarily good for them. How did you weigh that consideration?
Well, that weighed very heavily in what we did. So one of the things that we did, we brought in extra activity staff to make sure that our residents had visits every day. And then because they were taking meals within their rooms, we brought in a chef, a culinary expert that could help our staff make sure that the meals were prepared in a way that was more pleasing for the residents. So, you know, putting a flower on the tray kind of meant a lot, you know, small things like that that mean a lot to them, making sure that mealtime was still a happy time for them. And so we made sure that we took seriously the emotional health of our residents.
Reverend, we know now nationally the toll the pandemic has taken on Black communities in particular. We know Black Americans are disproportionately getting infected and dying as a result. What is it like for you to be kind of an island of safety, a COVID-free island right now, while the community around you is still very much in harm's way?
Well, Amna, we've had to, even at my church, with this pandemic going on, our neighborhood is unfortunate that we don't have even a supermarket within the entire zip code of where my church is located. So we're having to feed people 7 days a week. Sadly to say, we are used to the disparities. This pandemic is affecting Black and brown communities in a way, and it's because of the systemic racism that's built into the system that, you know, don't allow food insecurity, for one, lack of access and affordability to proper health care. And so we know that we have to take additional extraordinary measures to protect ourselves.
And amid all of this, you have managed to keep your residents, your team, who the statistics say should be among the worst affected, you've managed to keep them safe. Do you think that you can keep that up, knowing we're still in, as experts say, in the first wave of the virus?
It is a massive undertaking to keep this going because people are getting tired, people are getting frustrated, but we just try to encourage them to continue to be patient, continue to be strong and courageous in this fight, and to make sure that, you know, keep your faith in God and keep doing what you know are the best practices for your residents. And we always simply err on the side of caution. If it's a minute 1% chance that a resident is going to be affected, then we do not take that chance.
Well, we wish you safety and we wish you good health and good luck ahead. That is Reverend Derek DeWitt, the director of the Maryland Baptist Aged Home. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Amna, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for telling our story. God bless.
On the NewsHour online right now, states are grappling with how to reopen as coronavirus case numbers climb. Our William Brangham talked with Dr. Ashish Jha, who's director of the Harvard Global Health Institute, to answer some viewer questions about the road ahead. You can find that on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.